So, how are you, Niall? Here we are, episode 4. Can't believe it, we've got this far. Episode 1 of In Your Nature podcast has already went live and we're getting great feedback. So, I think we're obliged to carry on.
Yeah, thanks to everyone who's listening. It's nice to know there are people actually out there listening to our ramblings and are enjoying it as much as we are. Because I must say, I've been looking forward to doing this all week and chatting to you about one of my favourite subjects.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. And it's buzzards on the agenda today. So, before we go, let's stick with the formalities.
This podcast is brought to you by Birdwatch Ireland, Laois and Offaly County Councils and the Keep Well Campaign, an initiative of the Government of Ireland with funding from the Healthy Ireland Fund and the Sláinte Care Fund delivered by Pubble.
Yeah, so brilliant. Here we go. Buzzards, a bird of prey, the poor man's eagle, if you like. Where do you go? They're just such a stunning species, really widespread. A lot of people have seen them and I know down in my neck of the woods in Laois, a lot of people would say, what are those big hawks? Sort of on the ESB poles all over the place. But of course, they're not hawks and they're not eagles. They're buzzards.
Yeah, it's been really interesting over the last few years, particularly to monitor the phone calls and the emails and the Facebook posts as well that come into us in Birdwatch Ireland. Because through those, you can actually monitor the spread of buzzards. Because the beauty of them is that you see them. Like, you're going to notice this honking great bird of prey. Like you said, they're almost like an eagle. And people do see them. And what's been really interesting is seeing how they've been spreading across the country. So it used to be that all of our inquiries pretty much about them were coming from East Leinster and from parts of Ulster as well. But over the last, I'd say, 10 years or so, we're starting to see them spreading westwards more and more. And now we get calls from all 32 counties of Ireland about the buzzards.
Yeah, absolutely. And no doubt they've nested in all 32 counties. And I was just doing a bit of research and homework for this. And I read an article that John Lusby, our raptor officer, did for Wings back in 2011. And he was saying back then that buzzards were confirmed to breed in 16 counties. And probably five more as well. So that makes it 21. But most certainly they're in all 32 now. And that's sort of 10 years later.
Yeah, it's of course, the buzzard is a species that's very widespread indeed and common across the water in Britain and all across Europe. So it's a species that, that tends to be very successful. It's kind of been an anomaly, really, that they've been up until now so rare in Ireland. Of course, a lot of that goes back to historic persecution. This is a bird, let's not beat around the bush. It's obviously been subject to all sorts of problems over the years with people hunting them and shooting them because they feared them. It's been great to see that mindset changing. I mean, there's still some places where there's some more work is needed, but the fact is most people now realize that these birds are nothing but a benefit to our countryside. It's great to have them there. They're no threat whatsoever, and that's why they've been able to re-expand across the country and recolonize. And they did it by themselves. They're not like the red kites or the two eagle species that had to be reintroduced. They did it by themselves. So
no, that's and that, no, I'm glad you brought that up. They're on their own steam, and I mean it's not been easy getting here. I mean, the timeline, if I just summarize it a little bit, back in the 19th century they went extinct due to persecution. And in the 1930s, they were making a bit of a recolonisation from Scotland, which ultimately failed because myxomatosis was then introduced, killing the rabbits, which was their main prey species, and that would have knocked them back. And again, going extinct in the 1960s, before, again, a recolonisation from Scottish birds in the 70s and 80s, only up north again, where a population was growing. But the spread down to the Republic of Ireland was very slow and not happening, and likely due to the use of strychnine, which was a poison used quite commonly to kill foxes and crows and other sort of vermin, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And buzzards, being carrion eaters and scavengers, were picking up those carcasses and dying of strychnine poisoning. And until 1991, when strychnine was banned in Ireland, they just couldn't push on past the border, really. But we're lucky, since it's been banned, they've been making slow and steady progress south and east, and now we're seeing them spreading well west.
Yeah, I mean, I see them now a lot of the time when I'm out walking around my area where I live in North Wicklow. Wicklow is a real stronghold for them. We're getting lots of reports from around Dublin. I haven't been able, because of COVID, I haven't been able to leave my area for quite a while. But I do remember for the last few years, anytime I'm driving on the M50 now, you see buzzards sitting on the lampposts, flying over the roads. And a lot of people tell me, oh, I've never seen them before. And if you're one of those people, I'd say you just haven't been looking at them and you haven't known what you've been seeing, because you have seen them. They're all over the place now. Big, big bird of prey. away, wingspan well over a meter, big broad wings, and they do look very much like an eagle. They're a lot smaller than an eagle, but they're still a hefty bird. And they often just perch there, waiting, looking for prey, because they're quite lazy hunters. You know, they'll take the easy option. They'll let the prey come to them rather than have to do all the work themselves. But one of my favorite things is at this time of year now, they're starting to soar in the sky. You get that mewing sound that they make, which I think is a beautiful sound.
Deadly. No, and again, thanks for teeing it up. Let's just stop and have a listen to that. Brilliant. And like, we're in the early days of spring now, and the first couple of days of nice sunshine just happened, just the last couple of days, and like a switch, you get the buzzards up on those thermals, and they're just gliding there and they're mewing away, and it's a beautiful sound and a great sign of spring. And suppose like it sort of asks the question, I mean, how high do we know buzzards fly? Do you know? What's the crack?
Well, in terms of buzzards, I'm not sure. I know that lots of these other birds of prey, or raptors as they're often called, they use these thermals, these columns of rising warm air, to get up high in the sky, then they can glide between the thermals. I know that some species of vulture have gone so high that they've actually been seen from commercial jet aircraft at their cruising altitude, which is insane. I don't think the buzzards go quite that high, because they wouldn't really need to. They're not migratory birds, really. They are to a little bit of a degree in Southern Europe, but not so much here. They just sort of drift around. So they want to get high enough so they can see their prey, but still they don't want to go to too much effort.
That image,
quite lazy, like I said.
That image of a griffin vulture sort of drifting beside your Boeing 747 flight is just really quite terrifying. And in a past life, I used to do some work for Dublin Airport, and I'd be monitoring bird strikes and bird strike papers and literature and stuff. And there was one paper that suggested they fly it around when we're flying high, migrating, circling around 400 metres. But they have been up to 1,000 metres. Mm. And there's been bird strikes of common buzzards at 1,000 metres. So they do get up there. And it's quite amazing. And I suppose at 400 metres, they're probably scanning the landscape for carrion and, potential prey. But at 1,000, you'd be wondering. I mean, it's probably just migration or sheer fun. I don't know.
If I could do that, I would, because I imagine it must be a laugh, you know, going up that high. I don't know if buzzards think in those terms, but the fact is, though, it's a very efficient way for them to move between A and B, and they would have some predators themselves, at least, in other parts of their range, not so much in Ireland. Obviously, a fox on the ground would grab them if they could. In a lot of continental Europe, one of their big predators are actually eagle owls. So just imagine there's a big owl that actually eats big birds of prey. We don't have those in Ireland, but perhaps that sort of ancestral memory is still there somewhere in their genes.
People probably have seen eagle owls in Attenborough documentaries and stuff, but if you haven't, get on Google straight away and YouTube and just check out the videos.
Oh, they are. No, they're amazing birds. We in Ireland, we have three other species of owl here, the long-eared owl, the short-eared owl, and the barn owl. They're impressive birds. They're nowhere near as big as an eagle owl. It's an aptly named bird. So the buzzards in other parts of the world, they have to look out for those. But here in Ireland, they don't have much by way of natural predators, especially when they're flying. And so a lot of it, I think, is, moving from A to B. And then, as you said, with a slightly lower altitude, scanning for food, because like most birds of prey, they have phenomenal eyesight. They really leave us in the shade. Several birds of prey, it's only just been found in recent years, they actually have the center of their vision zooms in, so it's actually magnified. So they're looking from a great height, they're looking for their favorite foods. And one of the reasons why buzzards are so successful when they're not persecuted is that they eat a very wide diet. And I always think of them as the real farmer's friend, because they love to eat rabbits, they love to eat rats, they love to eat young crows as well. But they'll also quite happily to eat things like frogs and even earthworms. Earthworms are a big part of their diet, so they're able to switch to things that, like a blackbird would feed on as well. So they're real generalists, which is why they're so successful.
Yeah, they're great. And I know I spoke to John Lusby only yesterday about buzzards, and he reminded me of the three R's, which you said is rats, rabbits and rooks, which are all considered sort of vermin or, unwanted visitors to most farms. So they're certainly the farmer's friend, but there's a lot of misinformation out there that they sort of kill lambs as well. I'm not going to claim that maybe has never happened, but there's no way they have the hardware or the size to kill a healthy lamb. So what's probably happened and what's probably found its way into sort of people's psyche in certain quarters is probably mixing them up with the likes of white-tailed eagle or a larger raptor that can and do on occasion kill lambs. and otherwise maybe have found a buzzard peck in the eyes of an already dead lamb or something like that, like a carrion crow or a hooded crow would hear. So, and those things, you know, once they get into sort of the rumour mill and social media and just into people's psyche, it's very hard to sort of get that out. So it's, I suppose it's up to people like us to advocate for buzzards and sort of get the truth and the facts out there.
Yeah, it is. That's right, Ricky. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. I think there's a lot of some prejudices built up. And of course, you know, this is a bird that people weren't used to seeing. So I can understand why people are nervous about them, because they are very big, impressive, majestic looking birds. The funny thing is, of course, that a lot of that is just feathers. They don't actually weigh a huge amount. There's no way on earth they could actually lift a lamb or something like that. They wouldn't even attempt it. I've seen them, like even an Irish hare is too big for them. They're not going to bother with that. I think that what's happening, yeah, they find dead or stillborn lambs and they'll scavenge on those. They'll feed on them. They'll take the easy option. But no, they don't, there's no threat to the actual living lambs or to healthy lambs themselves.
But they have not got the capacity or the manoeuvrability like a sparrowhawk or a goshawk or whatever to kill birds in flight or anything like that. They're basically big lumps that are sitting in a tree waiting for a magpie to land on the ground in front of them. And they'll basically land and clatter them and kill them that way. They'll just subdue them that way. We mentioned frogs there, and just this week a really interesting tweet came up. A lady called Susanna Crampton, who people might know, she had the Cat Shepherd Twitter handle, and she raises Warble's sheep, those black sheep, and she's really interesting Twitter handle and tweets. But just this week she heard a splush in her farm pond, and when she got around the corner to see it, it was buzzard. After going in there fishing for frogs, and you could see the outline in the duckweed of where this buzzard had been in the pond fishing for frogs. So it's crazy. They'll really take advantage of anything. And I've seen them on a reserve where I worked in the UK. The next door neighbours, the farmers, used to use a forage harvester, and when they did that beside these sort of lovely ponds, the frogs were exposed, and the herons and the buzzards would alight on this field in their tens. And in even hundreds sometimes, and they would just pick off the frogs like it was a party. It was amazing to watch.
Yeah, frogs are interesting creatures, and they're generally safe from a lot of other predators too, because they have a toxin in their skin that makes mammals feel very sick. So if a fox or a dog makes the mistake of trying to eat a frog, they'll only do that once, because it makes them, okay, that poor frog might perish, but they'll spontaneously vomit. It really is very unpleasant for them, and so they learn not to do it. But birds are immune to that toxin, so buzzards and other birds of prey can quite happily feed on frogs without any ill effects. So I think the frogs really aren't expecting to have a predator perhaps creeping up them the way the buzzard does, because up until the buzzards recolonized, the frogs kind of had it all their own way. So it's kind of nature rebalancing itself again, I think.
Yeah, true. And like you say, like, we didn't have that apex predator in the landscape for a long time, because well over 100 years ago, red kites, white-tailed eagles, what else, golden eagles and buzzards went extinct in our landscape. So we're only finding our feet there again. So so we'll see what happens. And like you say, things will find the balance. We said they're a large raptor, but we've kind of skipped the description. But they've got this certain jizz, like this shape and size and look about them, that you can spot them, their silhouette, from a great distance. But to describe their plumage is sort of a fool's errand, because they're highly variable.
They are, yes. And, the sort of the typical buzzard is fairly brown overall, and they kind of have white patches sort of at the what look like the elbow joints in their wings. So when you see them soaring, that's what you'll often see. And that's sort of the standard one. And they sort of have a sort of a dark band across the chest, mainly. And most of the ones in Ireland look like that. But there's a lot of individual variation. And especially when you go to the continent, where there's a bigger population of them, you see some buzzards that are almost white, some that are almost black. Some of the ones in the eastern part of Europe are very sort of foxy red colour. And you can kind of see all of those in a bit of a mishmash in Ireland as well. So yeah, it doesn't really stick to necessarily the image that you might have in your field guide. They're very, very variable. So it's more the size and the shape and the flight action that distinguishes them really from the other birds.
Yeah, I think, you know, mostly when my friends or family text me and just the description is huge bird of prey circling, and I can hear this high pitched call, and you're going buzzard all day long. And then you get these sort of repeat descriptions all the time, you know, small hawk hovering, and you're like, kestrel all day long, no question. Or, you know, small bird of prey just, you know, took the head off a sparrow in my garden, sparrowhawk. And it's just, they all have their own characteristics and sort of habits that just you know, you can nail the identification without ever seeing the bird all the time. It's feeding to a lot of the stereotypes. Where do they nest?
So, yeah, the nest, it's quite a big platform sort of sticks that they make, and it's usually in quite dense woodland, if they can find that. So they're very secretive when they're nesting. So for a bird that's so conspicuous when it's flying around, at the nest site itself, they try not to draw attention to it. So if you have a woodland stand near you and you see buzzards in the air, they may well be nesting, but right in the middle of that, usually not at the very edges. And they particularly seem to like trees, particularly conifers, where the top is broken off because it gives kind of a flat platform, a sort of a level space to put the nest in. But I mean, beggars can't be choosers, and they wouldn't necessarily have their pick of the best nesting site. So they're pretty, they're pretty accepting of all sorts of different habitats too. So, optimally woodland, but they'll make do with smaller stands of trees if they have to.
That they will always reline the nest with some nice, fresh green foliage, which is, I think, sort of strange enough for a raptor. And I mean, I think the platforms can be made of all sorts, bones and old bits and bobs of all sorts, and it can be quite huge because they will reuse nest sites and they will rotate nest sites because they're quite a long-lived animal actually. And I know the longevity record is from the BTO and international ringing records is 28 years and 9 months, so nearly 29 years, and that's the ones we know about that were caught or found with rings. So it's probably a bit older than that, which is quite amazing. 30 years for any wild bird, really.
It is. If you contrast that with something like a wren, if a wren makes it to the age of two, it's doing extremely well, you know. Life is tough for a lot of our birds. So to make it to close to 30 for a big bird of prey like that, that's pretty impressive, all right. And of course, the longer they live, the better they are at learning the tricks of the trade and surviving. So the ones that make it past their first few years, they tend to have long lives because they've learned how to do it.
It is. It's their fourth year before they get to become in full adult plumage as well. And I suppose for the nerds, they can pick out the old plumage in a 3 and a 4 year old bird, you know, the juvenile feathers. And even, I mean, the iris colour is something to look for as well, which is, I do a bit of bird ringing, and you can identify, or at least it's one of the indications of a buzzard's age by the colour of the iris. And it gets darker, you can't see the pupil after a while if it's a full adult bird, which I think is really interesting.
You mentioned ringing there. I imagine that when you're ringing a buzzard, you have to be kind of careful, because I know a lot of people see that sharp beak and they think that, oh, we'll have to stay away from that. But that's bad enough. But those claws, those talons are much worse.
Oh, on all birds of prey, and it's the feet that are the dangerous. That's where the heavy hardware are. The beaks are made for tearing flesh from bones and plucking feathers, fine. And they could give your finger a bit of a nip. But if one of those, and their legs are incredibly long, because we don't ever see the full length of their legs. They're kind of stuck up in a lot of, like, you know, those body feathers. You don't ever see them, but they can reach. And I seen not with a buzzard, but in the UK I seen a woman get her nose pierced by a kestrel because she was too busy keeping the beak away from herself. She thought that was going to be the thing that was going to take her eye out. But then it reached forward and just grabbed her in the nose, and it took us a long time to to extract its foot from her nose. It was a bloody affair. So yeah,
I shouldn't laugh. Sorry about that.
No. But if you ever rescue a buzzard or whatever, just grab it by the wings and put it in a box and just mind its feet. That's probably goes for every raptor, really.
Yeah, they do need to be treated with a very healthy respect, because, of course, you know, when you do find a bird that's been injured or it's sick or somehow, when it sees a human approaching, of course, they're worried. They're worried that they're about to be killed. So they see us as a threat, and they're going to defend themselves. They're going to lash out. They don't realize that we're trying to help them. And the thing is, you know, for all of these birds of prey with their big, strong, tough reputations, in fact, they're very highly strung. They can get distressed very, very quickly, and they really don't like to be touched or approached by people. You know, when they're out of their comfort zone, they really do show it. So some birds get very docile when they're handled. That's often a sign of stress as well. Birds of prey are very, very nervous. I mean, you need to remember that too. You know, a nervous wild animal has to be treated with a lot of care.
No, totally. And actually, just talking about birds of prey and finding injured ones or whatever, because buzzards and other birds of prey, unfortunately, are still targets of poisonings and other sort of stupidity, they do show up sick and unwell in strange circumstances and in random places. So they do tend to be the kind of species that are found. And the trouble is, if they've been exposed to strychnine or carbifurin, that is toxic to humans and pets. So you have to be very careful when you're handling an animal like that, or even a carcass. Just be aware, because the National Parks and Wildlife Service would be very interested, and John Lusby, our raptor officer, if you're finding certainly individual raptors, but if you find more than one in a particular area, you could be looking at a sort of, you know, poisonings, whether it's mistaken, or purposeful stuff, targeted stuff, it's really can be nasty. But just be wide of it, because it can be damaging to humans and to pets as well. So just be careful. And I suppose that brings us on to wildlife crime and to raptor sort of persecution and poisoning. And in 2019, there was a huge case. 23 buzzards were poisoned and found on farmland in Cork. And it was ruled out quite quickly that it was nothing to do with the farm owner. And but the investigation is still ongoing, and there was a 5,000 quid reward offered for anyone that could give information that would lead to an arrest. And as far as I know, that's still wide open.
I believe that reward has been claimed. It has been paid out. So it would be interesting to see if a prosecution will follow. But the organisation that put up that reward, which was an independent charity, it's nothing to do with the state, they announced there a few weeks back that they have paid out that reward based on information that they received. So hopefully National Parks and Wildlife Service will be able to take action on this. You know, that was an absolutely terrible case, you know, with these 23 buzzards found poisoned there near Timmerleague. And the heartbreaking part of it as well is that's 23 that were found in a small area. And the fact is, there must be many more who went off to die in agony in the forests, were never discovered. You know, it's terrible. And it was actually the landowner in that case, he's the person who reported it. So there's absolutely no suggestion that he was involved in any way. He was as horrified as we are about it. It's terrible this is still happening. I mean, despite the best efforts of these idiots, these birds are still increasing, which is great to see. So they're not stopping the spread of the buzzard as much as they would like to. I don't know why they want to do this. It seems crazy. But you made a very good point there about the toxins and the poisons that are used. The substance that was used in this Cork poisoning incident, that was carbifuran, which is an illegal substance here in Ireland. I believe it was originally used as a pesticide on crops, but it was actually withdrawn from sale pretty quickly because it's so toxic. Even a tiny amount of it will kill a person. We've had situations, and we've come across them, where people have put poisoned meat bait on the ground. It could be cubes of meat, sometimes even it's live birds that are tethered to the ground. They have this carbifuran on them or in them. And the fact is that if someone went to try and help a buzzard that was poisoned and had this carbifuran on its feathers, or it found maybe a tethered live bird as bait with this poison on it, if that splashed into your mouth or you got it on your hand and you touched your thumb against your tongue or your eye, you could die. There was an incident with a peregrine falcon family in Dalkey in South County Dublin a few years ago, where some pigeons have been left tethered alive with this the substance
in
their
back. That was nuts, I remember that. Yeah.
And there was two ladies were out walking and they found these pigeons tied with wire, and they wanted to help them. They didn't know why they were there or what was being targeted. It was near a peregrine nest. So they pulled them up and they took them and then took them to a vet and took them for safety, and rang me to ask what they should do. And my first advice was, you must immediately get to a doctor, because it's very important to check you haven't ingested any of this. On those pigeons, turns out there was enough carbifuran to kill 200 people. That's how toxic this stuff is. So it's a real big issue here. Obviously, from Bird O'Chernan's point of view, we're very concerned about the buzzards and the other birds of prey. But it's a human health issue here as well. I hope to God it doesn't get to a stage where action is only going to be taken in a serious way when someone dies. That would be tragic.
Yeah, and well, it's nuts because, I mean, there's two crimes really, as was pointed out in the papers, because it's illegal to sell the stuff. Now, unless some dude had it in his shed for years, I don't know how long it lasts. But it could be the case, or there's a sort of black market for this stuff, and which is begs the question what people are using it for. It's lethal. But then, just talking about poisoning, it's all a bit grim. But we can't go past poisoning of raptors without talking about secondary poisoning, which is a huge thing. And if we come to talk about barn owls in the future, it'll definitely come up again, and rightly so. It's true the likes of rat poison, which is put out for rodents in many sort of situations, farms and industrial sites and even residentially. Barn owls and buzzards eat rodents, and they will target ones, and obviously they'll catch ones that are a bit, if a rat's poisoned, it'll be a bit out of it, because those things are neurotoxins, and they make them act funny and they weaken their state. So it's going to be an easy target for a buzzard or a barn owl, which are going to take back, eat it, it themselves, or feed it to their young. And over time, the poison builds up in their liver, even if it's only tiny amounts. And one day, just the barn owl is going to fall out of the sky, or the buzzard in this case. So there's a lot of work ongoing in the raptor conservation world and with Birdwatch Ireland and John Lusby to talk about secondary poisoning and alternatives to using rat poisons and protecting where you put the baits. live trapping and various things like that. So just be wide of it and educate yourself, and there's loads of information out there.
This is a case where obviously where people aren't intending any ill will towards these birds. It's just it's inadvertent, but it's nonetheless destructive because of that. And I know that one of the most startling things about John's findings in relation to poisoned birds of prey, and particularly in relation to barn owls, but it might hold for other species as well, he was finding that the birds that had that tended to have poison in their systems, what was happening to them was that they were more likely to be hunting along the sides of busy roads because it was easier pickings for them. They felt unwell, they felt less fit, so they took the easy option trying to get the mice at the side of the road. They're much more likely then to be hit by trucks and cars, so they were being indirectly killed by the poison in that way as well. Another thing that you'll see sometimes with buzzards particularly, sometimes you find them very unfortunately dead below electricity pylons. And in that case, what's usually happened is it's not foul play. They've actually been electrocuted by the wires. So you'll see like small birds, let's say sparrows or starlings or whatever, they can quite happily perch on a wire. What's happening is the electricity is actually flowing through them, but they're not grounded. There's no earth connection there. So it doesn't actually cause many problems. What happens though, if a bird touches a wire and the pylon or touches two wires simultaneously, then they'll be electrocuted. And a buzzard being a big bird, if it opens its wings and the wings happen to touch two wires, they'll be fried. So unfortunately, that's sometimes where they're found below the wires.
No, I didn't know that. That's wild. Talking about sort of pylons and buzzards on poles, and another wildlife crime case is back in my neck of the woods, in Emo, a small sort of picturesque village in Leash, some idiot took a pot shot and it killed a buzzard, just shot a shotgun off the side of the road at a buzzard on a top of a telecom pole before Christmas there. And there was a reward raised locally as well to try find who was sort of involved. But it hasn't gone anywhere yet, as far as I know. But that's quite common, people just taking pot shots at these things. I think they've some sort of right to rid the countryside of these horrible predators. It's just bizarre.
It is. And I know that the thing is as well, a lot of people complain about the density of crows we have in Ireland. So rooks, jackdaws, hooded crows, magpies, birds like that. And they have their place in the environment, of course, as well. But one thing that a lot of foreign visitors, be them from Britain or from continental Europe, when they come to Ireland and, you know, they're bird watchers, they say to me, like, how come in Ireland you have so many crows? And it's true. We have far more than they would across the water just in Wales or in, let's say, France or Germany. And one of the big reasons for that is that those crows are filling a niche that has been vacated because so many of our big birds of prey are missing. Because what happens is, not alone do birds like buzzards prey on those, on the young of those crows, but they outcompete them for things like carrion at the side of roads or dead animals in fields. And when you don't have buzzards there to do that, what happens is you get the crows, the magpies and so forth, filling that vacuum. And so actually for farmers and people who don't want so many crows around their land, killing buzzards or pushing them out of the area is actually detrimental, because you're just going to increase the crow population. That's what happens. So it's something that we really want to get the message across about.
It's bloody dangerous taking a pot shot at an animal from the side of the road, you know, to humans and to livestock and all sorts of stuff. Definitely don't want to beat up on farmers and gun clubs. But there certainly seems to be a thing that, like, you know, buzzards attack pheasants all the time. And they're sort of, pheasants were made, it's like they were made for buzzards, in fairness. They're the right size, they're ground dwellers, they're not the smartest, they rarely fly. Once they're released from their cages in November to be shot, they're sort of fair game to buzzards. But unfortunately, to some people with double-barreled shotguns, that's not their plan, and they'll have a pot shot at the buzzards as well, which is not on, really.
Yeah, no, I mean, the thing is, the pheasant, of course, isn't a native Irish bird. They're not a natural part of our ecosystem. And we do have a fairly small, like, core wild population that behave as wild birds. They have their wild instincts and they hide away from people and from predators. But the vast majority of pheasants that we see, and therefore also that the buzzards see, as you said, they're ones that have been reared in high densities in captivity. They've never been in the wild before. They know nothing about wild instincts. They've never looked out for a predator in their lives. They even associate humans with food. They're easy pickings for a bird like a buzzard. And you know, that's the problem. The fact that, you know, that the fact that people are calling for the culling or the removal of this native bird of prey to try and protect these very naive captive reared pheasants, it's absolutely ridiculous. You know, that's, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of hunters and shooters who are interested in our podcast.
Absolutely.
And I know that many would agree. Maybe some would disagree with that. But the fact is, those pheasants, they don't behave like wild animals, and it's not surprising that buzzards would go for them. What the statistics show is that far more of them are actually killed on the roads by cars. So that's one of the biggest, the biggest thing. And of course, the thing is, these pheasants were never destined for a long, happy life. They're going to be shot a few days or weeks later anyway.
Listen, we've segued now into bird of the week.
Oh, good stuff.
Let's do pheasant as species of the week now, or bird of the week.
Okay, good choice. Yeah.
It's interchangeable title.
I really like pheasants, I must say. They're really beautiful, particularly the males. They're such a colourful bird. There's something really really unusual about them. As I said, they're not a native bird to Ireland, and you kind of know it by looking at them. They don't really resemble anything else that we have.
Well, I'm going to level with you here.
Yeah.
In my head, as a conservationist, says, get those dirty yolks out of here. They do not belong here. They compete with our own ground nesting species. They don't do too well in the wild here anyway, because they're not really birds of the open country. They need kind of woodland copse and stuff like that. They were introduced from Asia as far back in Ireland from, I think, the 16th century. Mm-hmm. Probably vanished for a while. And then when sport shooting became popular again, the British plantations and stuff, and they had all their estates and that sort of thing was going on, they would have been introduced again for shooting. And that tradition remains. They probably, if they were not helped out, or, you know, if they were not reintroduced every year in their hundreds and thousands for gun clubs, would they survive in Ireland?
I think certainly the population number would be way, way lower. Because, yeah, most of the ones we see are birds that have been released from captivity. There are probably a canny few who can survive quite well in the wild, and they've raided the guns for several generations. So they've, you know, reverted back to sort of their wild state. But they are a strange bird. I mean, they have a huge range all across Asia, really. It's quite a common bird throughout much of Asia. But there are many, many different forms of them, different subspecies that look quite different. And the ones we have here in Ireland are now kind of a hodgepodge of many different types, and they're not necessarily genetically very fit. Also, we get quite a few reports every year of albino pheasants, you know, snow white ones. That's generally a sign of genetic weakness, a sign of inbreeding. It seems to happen in pheasants more than any other bird you see in the Irish countryside.
I know two main types, and as a boy, all my uncles would have shot my granddads, and they would have always said the Chinese ring-necked pheasant. Mm-hmm. And the other fella, I don't know what they call the other guys, just the ones without the ring, which would be quite common. The guys we get around here with the gun clubs are often the ringnecks. And then occasionally they interbreed them with, I think, what they used to call an Indian black pheasant, because the ringneck fellas wouldn't fly or high enough or wouldn't do what they wanted them to do. They weren't any sport for shooting. So they would interbreed them with ones that were a bit more lively. So, like I say, there's a huge just hodgepodge of stuff out there.
Yes, I mean, the species ranges all in the native range all the way from the Caucasus right across to Japan and Taiwan. And a lot of the birds that are found sort of in the parts of Asia that are closest to Europe, so near the Ural Mountains, that kind of area, and also the Caucasus, they're quite dark, they're a bit smaller. And then as you go further east, they tend to be a bit bigger, a bit lighter in colour, and they have that white collar, that white ring around the neck. And many different subspecies are mixed together because there's dozens of them out there. And that's what's happened there. And also sometimes you'll see some melanistic forms that look almost black. I remember there was one at our East Coast Nature Reserve in Newcastle here in County Wicklow. It was around for a couple of years, and the pheasant was literally like a lovely blue. It was almost an iridescent blue colour with kind of a normal pheasant head on it. What could be going on there as well is there's a very closely related species in Japan called the Japanese green pheasant. Some of their genes of that species are in our pheasant populations as well, perhaps. So that could be what's happening. So some of these genes from previous generations sort of get expressed. But what we have is that, you know, that means that they're kind of birds that don't really behave or aren't really equipped to survive in a natural setting. They never would have arisen in a wild state.
They mostly eat seeds and stuff and small invertebrates. I know there's a move now in England, and I don't know if they've got anywhere with it or if it's been made official in any way, but they're beginning now to at least have the conversation, and maybe locally in some counties it's actually actioned, but they're not releasing them for shoots anywhere near protected areas and nature reserves where they might compete with the likes of maybe grey partridge and other ground nesting species for nest sites and for resources. So I think that's a fair balance. And in a country like England, where tradition and their shooting tradition is so deeply ingrained, I think it would be a tough battle to win, you know, and it's probably a good compromise for everyone.
It is. I mean, the sheer amount of food that the released pheasants must consume, it's going to be having a detrimental impact on other threatened species, both birds and mammals. So you mentioned the grey partridge there. I think that's a very good example. They would be direct competitors in many cases, particularly with the pheasants. If they're there in artificially high numbers, they're eating a lot of food and they're bigger than the partridges. So they're going to be pushing them out of certain areas. And so it stands to reason that's one of the main drivers behind the decline of that species, the grey partridge. So yeah, you're right. It's all about it's all about balance. I know some people listening to us will completely disagree with us, and so be it. But I do think we need to find a balance there, and certainly protecting protected areas and special conservation areas, I think, is a good start at least. That's good. We get a balance there at least.
And I know I said there, look, the purist in me would once sort of said, just like, they don't belong here, and they're competing with natives. Let's not have them. But that's my head. But in my heart, I'm saying they're absolutely stunning. The males are really nice, and they're definitely, like, I mean, my part of the world here around this part of Laois, North Laois, is in the winter, the cold mornings, foggy mornings, stubble fields. You just, you know, and the pheasants, you just see the male pheasants are in the summer with, you know, the male pheasant with his harem of females. It's just a real summer thing, and it's just it's like a memory that was always there in my head. And I think I would lament the loss of the pheasant in the Irish countryside if anyone actually did action it, and you know, if the minister decided, okay, let's get rid of these things. They are kind of, they're naturalised here now, and it'd be a weird one to see them go.
I must admit, I do like that call the male makes when he's displaying that very distinctive sound of the Irish countryside there. That sort of, it's almost like a choke, sort of double cough almost. It's very hard to describe, but it's very distinctive.
And then that vibration of the wings.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yes.
Let's listen to it. That vibration carries miles. Like, you'd hear those on a still morning from quite a distance. The male, again, like the sexual dimorphism, the difference between the male and the females in all pheasants, in the pheasant family, there's a big range of species, like you mentioned earlier on, of pheasants, and they're all confined to Asia, except where they've been introduced as feral populations. But in 99% of the cases, the females are these brown, drab things, and the males are absolutely, like, mad-looking yokes and stunning, handsome beasts. Like, crested fireback, like, Google those fellas. Lady Amherst pheasants, which people might know from, they're kind of often used in as cage birds.
Yes.
And golden pheasants, again, definitely there's a tradition in the UK of having them as captive birds. And the males in those species are absolutely out of this world.
Yeah, you could tell a lot by what we call this sexual dimorphism, the difference between the males and the females. You mentioned as well about our pheasants having these harems of females. That's the way pheasants breed. It's common to many pheasant species. And in that, what happens is the male wants to show off. He wants to impress as many females as possible. He'll mate with all of them and they'll raise the chicks. But he plays no role whatsoever in the rearing of those chicks. That's all left to the ladies. So he can afford to be as flashy and as showy as he wants. But she needs to be camouflaged because she's incubating the eggs. She's protecting those chicks, so she wants to blend in. So that's why there's such a difference. So when you see a big difference between the males and the females in terms of coloration and plumage, it's usually often a sign that one plays a much bigger role in rearing the chicks than the other does. If you take, for example, a bird like a robin, where the male and female look absolutely identical, they both, male and female, pretty much split the parental duties 50-50. So they both need to be camouflaged. They also both need to be a bit showy on the front to defend a territory, all of that. With the pheasants, it's completely different. And probably, you know, the most familiar pheasant is one that all of us know, even if people didn't realise it was a pheasant, is the domestic chicken, because that's a type of pheasant. It's a different species. It's descended from a wild species called the red jungle fowl, which you get in Southeast Asia. And that's another great example, the big difference between, you know, a hen and a rooster. It's that's exactly the same thing.
And the other thing we get as well is sort of from, I suppose, June, July, maybe late summer, when the young pheasants are out, you often get these calls and photos of people saying there's corncrakes on the road, because the young pheasants are kind of gawky looking yokes. They're kind of miniature versions of the modder. They're quite strange, way bigger than what a corncrake is like, but most people would haven't a clue what size a corncrake is. But we get lots of inquiries or reports of corncrakes all over the country, but again, it's just juvenile pheasants.
Yes, that's actually a thing that happens quite a bit. And people often say to us, I saw a family group of corncrakes walking along the road. Well, the first indication there is you won't see corncrakes walking along the road. They hide. They really do not come into the open. You know, I've been birdwatching all my life, and I can count the number of times that I've seen a corncrake on the fingers of one hand. And even then, it's just been a fleeting glimpse for a couple of seconds as one maybe dashes between nettle patches or something. They really don't come out in the open very much. The other other sort of test as well is when you see like what turns out to be a female pheasant walking along with her young chicks behind her, I would often ask people what colour were the chicks, because pheasant chicks are, they're beautiful little things, they're kind of different shades of brown, almost an orangey brown on the head, and they're gorgeous. Corncrake chicks are jet black, they're great little lumps of coal, and so they're quite different in appearance. So I can understand if people aren't familiar with the corncrake anymore. The corncrake is a lot smaller even than a juvenile pheasant. They're small birds compared to a pheasant.
Corncrake chicks are amazing. I remember first seeing them and didn't believe that little like jet black thing was, I thought someone was pulling my leg. They're really, really stunning little things. People should Google that for definitely. We've got more episodes ahead, so really looking forward to our next episode. We've got our first interview, so we're bringing in a new voice. We're going to be talking bogs with Catherine, Dr. Catherine Farrell, formerly of Bord na Mona, now with Trinity College Dublin. She really, really knows her onions in terms of Irish bogs, and looking forward to speaking to her next week. Yeah, so in the meantime, check out our website, birdwatchireland.ie, if you want to join, that you get all the information on membership there.
It's a great time of year to be watching birds. It's a time to be watching out for migrants as well at the moment, so keep an eye out for those. And just a quick plug for a lovely project that we do each year along with our BirdLife International partners across Europe, Central Asia and Africa. It's called Spring Alive. So when you see your first swift, swallows, cuckoos, sand martins or ringed plovers of the year, if you go to springalive.net and log them for us there, we'd really appreciate that. And that's a lovely project run by BirdLife International. It's sponsored by Heidelberg Cement. And I'm always very proud of the fact that although this operates in over 40 countries, we get more records per capita from Ireland than from any other country, which is great.
That's brilliant. And you all know about my soft spot for swifts, so make sure you report your swifts. And I think Irish people like robins, they just have a huge growl for swallows. So yeah, I'm sure it's going to be very popular again this year, and loads of people be putting in their sightings. So yeah, so thanks to our sponsors. This podcast is brought to you by Birdwatch Ireland, Laois an Offaly County Councils and the Keep Well Campaign, an initiative of the Government of Ireland with funding from the Healthy Ireland Fund and the Sláintecare Fund delivered by Pubble. In Your Nature is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.